How can AI help the happiest country in the world get even happier? Hello and welcome to Tech First. My name is John Gutierrez. You've probably heard of Bhutan. You may even have heard of Bhutan's gross national happiness measurement, which is about measuring how happy a country is as well as how wealthy a country is. Now, the royal family in Bhutan is establishing an AI center. The goal? Bringing Bhutan happiness to AI. To chat, we've got a personal advisor to the royal family, one of the people involved in this whole process, Enrique Hernandez. Welcome, Enrique.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for allowing me to be over here and give a brief intro to what we're doing over there in Bhutan. Appreciate it.
Hey, it is great to see you, Enrique. It's got to be a couple of years since we've seen each other. The last time we were in Jamaica. I believe, and we went on some crazy adventure. We had some driver and some car. We went on the back roads. We ate goat in some village in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica. I remember my pile of bones from that meal was like this. Yeah, softball. I don't know if there was any meat there whatsoever. And then we went to this place where you can get massages in the natural hot springs and mud and everything. And you had people fighting over you trying to massage.
Pretty much.
It's been a long time. It's good to see your face. Awesome. Let's jump in. What is going on in Bhutan with AI?
I got an invitation to go to Bhutan last year with the idea to talk to them about crypto and see which things we can do over there, investments, things like that. And so when I went over there last year, I was amazed by what they have to measure productivity or to measure progress. And so that was when I learned about the GNH, Gross National Happiness Index. And so it's very peculiar that then the way that they measure the progress of their country is not by GDP, right? Gross Domestic Product. Like almost, I'd probably say, 100% of countries worldwide, right? So I started just asking them, what's GNH? What does it stand for? What is this? And that was when I first learned that what is the purpose of economic progress if people are not happy, right? If there is no sense of the happiness and spirituality of people in all of this, right? And that's in terms of measuring progress, right? So combined with nature and combined with being able to have a home or a country for the next generation. And so that just stuck into me in my mind. And so when I came back, you know, that just kept, I guess, boiling in my mind and thinking, wow, what an incredible country, right? That they can actually measure progress by the happiness of people, which ultimately that's what it should be. It should not be in a way that then, which it can be a little bit skewed. We can say, yes, GDP is going up. Yes, the stock market is going up. But how many people are really getting impacted by that, right? Are we skewing the data? Right? And is it just 10, 20, 30% that are taking good advantage of that progress or economic progress, and then the rest are suffering? Right? But just because you have such a big jump in economic movement, then when you do the bell curve and you normalize it, then it's just like, okay, yeah, we're making progress. Not sure. There are a lot of states that are in the United States that are not progressing
right now. Not feeling happy. Not feeling wealthy. Feeling better than they were some years ago. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And so then that stuck in my mind. And so when this whole thing with AI happened, and I started thinking about my time in neural networks or AI back in 2004, back in 2005. And so when I first started my career as an engineer, as an aerospace engineer for the U.S. Army, then at that time, I was in charge of doing drones, unmanned vehicles, UAVs. And so it was a very small but huge jump to go from unmanned vehicles to completely autonomous air vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking into that, neural networks, which is one division of machine learning, all of this. And so that was my first encounter, I will say, with software that is learning in such a way that you simply don't know what's going to happen, to put it very simply, right? So you just evolve. And the more data that you feed to this neural network, the more data that you feed to the machine, to the software, machine learning, right? Then it just takes a life to some extent on its own. And so I just remember that we were puzzled by how fast it was growing, you know, it was learning, and second, some of the decisions that it was making. And so if you put that kind of software into a drone, and if you put missiles or any kind of other weapons into that drone, now you have something that can be potentially very serious, because you don't know how it's going to react, the decisions that it's going to be making, are those decisions ethical or not? And so who's legally responsible, right? So at that early stage, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2005 marks a very important date for the U.S. military, because that was the year when the U.S. military started investing heavily in AI. And so we were faced with those very difficult questions very early on. And I was in the middle of all. So especially when we were thinking and hoping that then we will have drones in NAS, National Airspace. Well, if you have a drone in National Airspace and this drone happens to have an AI and happens to not like the way that other airplane, commercial airplanes are behaving, then what's going to happen, right? So we were facing with all of that. And so 2010, I left the government and left at work. And when I came back from Bhutan this year, and I started seeing more people starting to use AI and ChatGPT and some of the other software from Google, Bard from Google, then I was thinking, wow, I was really hoping that we probably will be a little bit more careful with this technology. But now that the genie is out there, then, you know, I know for a fact that making ethical decisions and making moral decisions is going to be at the foundation of this new revolution or evolution, right? However you want to see it. And so when I came back from Bhutan and I started talking to more people, and more people were coming to me to talk about AI and machine learning and neural networks, I said to myself, there's one country that at least I know that one way or another, they were able to solve this kind of ethical problem. And they have developed this whole economy and everything based on happiness. And so that was the beginning of then being able to go back to the royal family, to the princess, and then ask her, hey, will you be interested if we develop a center, an AI center that has as the foundation then gross national happiness and the gross national happiness concepts of ethics, morals, and that any kind of business that we accelerate in this center, any kind of AI-driven business, has to be based on an AI that already goes through some checks and balances of ethics and morals. And so what really pushed me to really go after this kind of an approach was because I was able to start tricking some of the AI that are out there. And I was able to make them lie to me. And so I started just questioning all this software and AI specifically, because trained people are taking the answers of AI as if you're talking about gospel, as if this is the ultimate truth. This is the Bible. This is
handed down from above.
Yep. Whatever it says over here, it has to be true. And so that just was my beginning, specifically also with a case that happened a couple of months ago when two trained attorneys were in court talking about a case, and they were then referencing this legal case. And the judge looked at them and asked them, what are you talking about? And after a couple of minutes looking at each other, they had to come clean and said, well, we actually got this from ChatGPT. And ChatGPT just gave them a complete fictional case It was like, my God, exactly. You're a trained attorney. Trained attorney. You have to pass a bar and everything, an exam. And you didn't know this. Wow. You imagine those attorneys being prosecutors and asking the judge to impose the most heavy penalty to someone based on on precedents, which is completely false, which is completely fictitious, right? So there's a lot of ethical dilemmas over here. And so to me, it's perfectly fine. And it's a tool. It's out there. We're not going to go back. So, but I then felt the need of then trying to guide this evolution of technology in the best way that I could, that I can, right? So
it's quite a leap, actually. It's quite a leap from building AI for tools of destruction, drones, perhaps even autonomous drones, which is a little freaky. We have some precedents for that in popular literature, popular culture, right? Terminator comes to mind, right? Skynet comes to mind, all that stuff. It's a massive leap from that to going to a place like Bhutan and saying, okay, how can we use AI, ethical AI, in the pursuit of happiness, in the pursuit of ethical ends? Super interesting. And I want to dive into what your goals, what the royal family's goals are with that and where that's going to go. How did you even get this connection? How did you even get connected with the royal family in Bhutan? As I understand it, it's not easy to get into Bhutan. I believe we chatted about this once. Not many people get a visa to go into Bhutan.
That is correct.
How did this happen?
That is correct. So when I got invited to go over there and talk about crypto, then it was a friend of mine that actually got me invited. He had studied with the princess. And so that was my connection. And then when I went over there, then easily for me, right? Because it was through the princess that then I was able to get the visa. And then while I was over there, I tried my best, right? Just to help them with anything related to crypto and this and mining, we can do this. And these are some of the other things that we can do. And the more that I talked to them and I guess gave them about crypto, then the more they open about some of the things that they would like to have, some of the things that they would like to see. The very delicate balance that they're trying to strike between being an open country and also preserving their culture, right? So that is something that they take very seriously, of trying to make sure that as they open the country, then they preserve the culture. And so why is that? The question is, why is that they need to open the country? And so one of the reasons is, the economy, right? You need to sell your products and services to someone else outside of your country, right? So that then you can have that exchange. And so, but also because of internal pressure of their own citizens, students that wanted to study in different places. So the young people that can, then they go to Australia to study over there and they get trained in Australia. They have some kind of agreement with Australia. They get trained over there. Some of them stay over there. Others come back.
Very
well-trained students. And unfortunately, when they come back, they don't have, like happens in a lot of countries. It happened also in my country, in Puerto Rico, right? You go back and then you don't have a job for what you study. And so it was the right moment, right time. And I was always talking to them. Once I came back, I kept talking to them about different things that we could do together. They have amazing, just amazing butter and rice and mushrooms over there as well. They actually have the most valuable mushroom in the world, which right now it's priced at around $68,000 per kilo. So very few people know about that mushroom, actually, on the Western world.
You gave me a sample of that mushroom. I think you gave that to me in Jamaica, and I have no idea what it's probably $3,000 worth of mushroom or something.
It's like a functional mushroom, right? So not a psychedelic, functional mushroom. Like if you were go and eat like truffles or shiitake mushroom, like that, or white mushrooms, but extremely healthy and beneficial mushroom. And so So I kept interested of all the natural resources that they have. Plus, something that attracted me as well is that by law, they put in law that they cannot cut more than 50 or 60% of the trees and the land they have. So by law, they already have embedded into their culture and to their law and to their government that, hey, we are here and we're here to preserve and to have that this kind of a balance between nature and us. And so the more that I talked to them, then the more they were interested in getting to know more things that we could do together in terms of commerce or selling somewhere else. And so when this idea of AI came about and I asked them, they were enthusiastic because there are a lot of students over there or graduates over there that are really good in computer engineers, right? They were trained in Australia. And now that they came back, they just do what most people do in Australia, which is agriculture. And so, well, they don't want to do agriculture. They much rather do computer engineering, right? So I told them, hey, I told the princess, if you find 30, 40 students, I don't care, however many, then I will take the time, even if it is 11-hour difference, I don't care. I will take the time, 3 or 4 p.m. your time, which is going to be your 4 or 5 a.m. in my time, I don't care. I will take the time to train them in 7 industries. AI in government, AI in finance, AI in healthcare, AI in tourism, AI in marketing, AI in agriculture, and AI in renewable energy. And so... Mm-hmm. 2 months ago, off we went. I started the whole training. And then from there, people got excited and interested. The princess also got an invitation to talk to the Royal Institute of Management, I think is what it's called, about what she's doing with the center, with the AI center. So out of the sudden, this started growing. And I talked to some of my friends that I have, some of them in Google. But I cannot say anything yet, but official, but some of them are in Google. And so they got excited as well. And cool. So that was what started this initiative of then being able to have this exchange of ideas between your culture, your wisdom, your ethics, and your happiness in Bhutan and our computers, our AI, and this software, which can, if used correctly, can be extremely beneficial to a lot of people. They can, and I'll say this, they are very concerned, just like a lot of people are. I am as well concerned about the potential loss of jobs, right? And replacements of jobs with all this. And I have said publicly that I do believe that between 30 to 50% of all jobs, current jobs, will disappear within the next 4 or 5 years. And so, you see already big companies talking about replacing their own consultants with AI. I think you cannot replace a doctor. And so AI is one of these technologies that I know of, the only technology in history that is actually able to replace high-skilled jobs, doctors, attorneys, engineers. In the past, it was always the low-skilled jobs, right? And people were happy whenever they see now a robot at a restaurant. Yes, now you're happy because they're always serving you. But what about you being happy when instead of a pilot, now you have an AI flying your airplane, complete AI flight? And so I tell people that are concerned about AI, I say, well, how much of the flight, of a normal flight, let's say any kind of flight, how much of that do you think is controlled by humans in percentage? And they're like 50% or whatever, 40%. No, you're talking. We're talking about maybe 10-15% of all their flights.
Yeah, I can believe that. I can believe that.
So only takeoff and landing, pretty much.
Yeah, I want to bring out. We've been talking about the princess, and I don't think we've introduced her actually. And yes. I want to bring her into the conversation. Her name is Princess Leona Wangchuck, and it is about 5 a.m. her time right now as we're recording this. But princesses don't get up at 5 a.m. usually. Why she's not on the call, and maybe, I don't know, maybe the connectivity is not amazing as well. But on your website for the center, there's a quote from her, and I'm going to read that because it's interesting and it speaks to her motivation for putting this together. And she says, there's a poignant quote that comes to mind. What if the cure for cancer is stuck in the mind of a child who can't afford education? This thought-provoking statement underscores the untapped potential that exists within individuals, especially when they are provided with the right tools and support. It reminds us that innovation knows no boundaries, and with the right resources, remarkable breakthroughs can emerge. In a world where medical challenges, human challenges, economy challenges are as diverse as the people they affect, AI represents a beacon of hope. It's truly amazing, she says, that through this class, I have the opportunity to hear many ideas that have the potential to completely shape the future of Bhutan. The exchange of innovative and transformative concepts in this learning environment is a testament to the power of education and collaboration in driving positive change. Super interesting. You talked about a lot of high-skill people who have come back to Bhutan and can't use it because the local economy is not set up to accept somebody who's trained for what they've trained. It looks like she's looking forward to what Bhutan will be and asking AI to take a role in that.
That's exactly right. And so just to give you an example of, and I truly believe the more that I learn about them, learn about their issues, then the more I am convinced of the potential of AI, not necessarily at the beginning for first world countries, whatever you define as first world countries, right? But as countries that their economies are, let's say, economically speaking, then they're small. And so one issue that I wrestled with just a couple of days ago is AI in agriculture. Bhutan is then their major source of revenue as a country is agriculture. So, and they have, like I said, they have amazing resources, natural resources, and butter and rice. It's incredible. And cheese as well. So I started asking them about, hey, let's start talking. Who of all of you was interested in applying AI in agriculture? And then they, as we started talking, then I found out that, yeah, most of what they eat comes from India. And I said, okay, so are you talking about maybe meat or something? Because they cannot kill any animal over there. And so, okay, maybe meat, but they still eat meat, but they cannot kill it. But so they import it from India. And I said, well, is it meat? And they were like, oh, just produce as well, cheese, butter. I said, wait, stop. Why butter? Your butter is amazing. Why butter? Well, because ours is more expensive. And I said, wait, let me understand something. You're talking about they have to fly this butter, whatever, 3,000 miles, 4,000 miles, or equivalent to 4.8 kilometers, 1,000 kilometers or something. You have to fly that. And so what you're telling me is that they have to fly or bring from that far away the butter and this, and it is still cheaper than your own? And they're like, yeah. I was like, wait, is it that maybe the people from India, is it that they use some kind of preservative or something that then allows for their perishables to last longer and therefore that it can be cheaper? And they were like, no, it's also natural, organic. I was like, wait, I don't understand. This is a police accident. And it just so happened that there's one, actually two ladies over there, that their family has big farms over there. And I said, can you please explain this to me? I want to understand the economics so that I understand. And they're like, Enrique, yes, you're right. We make this butter, we make this, but it takes us several days for us to take it from the farm to the center, to the warehouse, and from the warehouse to the city. And I said, why does it take you so long? Well, they don't have any roads. Their roads are in very dire conditions. And I was like, okay, so why don't you just build better roads? Well, the government takes a long time to make a decision. There's elections everywhere. Okay. Now I am starting to understand. Very similar to some of the issues that we have in the Caribbean and Latin America. I get it. Okay. In Africa as well. Okay, so because of the lack of transportation infrastructure, then it takes you so long that then by the time that you get to the warehouse and then from the warehouse to the city, then that specific item is just expired. You cannot eat it. You cannot consume it, right? Is that correct? Yes. I said, okay, I have a solution for you. And we can do this solution in 1 or 2 months. How about if, where are the farms? Are they closely located? Yeah, they're closely located in this. And then they show me, I said, okay, so how about if, and you said that the roads are pretty dark situation. Yes. Are they building something? they have been building for, okay, get it. I understand. I've been building for a long time. This is very similar to other countries. I get it. They don't, trust me, your guys are not the only ones. So don't think that it's only us. It happens a lot. So how about if then we get a helicopter, a drone helicopter, we fly it over there. Make sure that you have circle of helipad. Let's call it the helipad. And then you land over there. Yep. You attach it to the helicopter. It takes off. We can put an AI software to the helicopter so that it just continuously 24/7 flying back and forth between the farm and the warehouse. Because, and then the princess mentioned that then they, one of her initiative was actually to build a road from the warehouse to the city, which they did. So, okay, perfect. So once we get to the warehouse, we can go fast to the city, right? Yes. Okay, perfect. Then the biggest issue is just transporting from the
I had here. To think about this as you're talking right. about that. I just did an interview with Dronamics and they've got this cargo drone, carries 800 pounds or 1,500 miles. They're actually operating right now in Europe. It's the perfect situation. It requires a very short runway, but of course it'll be much cheaper to operate than a helicopter, right? And yeah, interesting.
Exactly right. That's a good example. So I said, hey, we can do this in 1 or 2 months. It requires very little money, if you think it on in a big sense. And any of you that decides to do this company, we can get the support from the government. We can get the support of the investment arm of the government as well. Whichever of you that decides to do this, I'm telling you right now, is rich because all the farmers have exactly the same issue. Right? Makes sense. And they're like, yeah. So that just gives you an example of some of the very nice applications that AI can have right away. Right now, one of the biggest issues that they have in healthcare, there are about 20, 30 doctors for 750,000 people. Let's do another area in education. Right? There are not that many teachers all over the country, and there are all these kids. And so how about then you can have an AI, train the AI in their local language, and then, yes, we're going to go through a process of trying to get that AI to connect with the students. I get it, but students and kids, they don't ever put an obstacle to kids. They will get somehow connected to that AI quicker than what you think, right? So don't think that you need to be this super-duper robot. Just put like a monitor over there and let's see what happens, right? At least they have something that is teaching them. Right now, they don't have anything.
Yeah. So it's interesting, though, if you think about it, right? Because the butter situation, I don't know how much they need AI. They need transport, right? And that's pretty simple to arrange. And you can do that with a small plane. You can do that with a variety of other things. There could be an AI component, but I'm pretty sure the butter in India that they're buying is not AI made as well, right? Or AI assisted. In terms of the education and the healthcare and stuff like that, I guess challenge number one, and you mentioned it, is getting AI to understand whatever language they speak in Bhutan. I don't even know what language that is, honestly.
It's dual. So they have the Sangka, which is their local language, but most people over there speak actually English.
Really?
So they are
trained. People without education in the farm?
No, people in the farms are mostly the local language. That's absolutely right. Right.
So if you're going to provide healthcare to them, you probably have to do it in their language, right? Which means you need to teach ChatGPT their language or something like that. How are you going to overcome that? Maybe one of the projects that the center will take on?
Yeah. Yes. So that is one of the verticals that we're tackling right now. There are people from Bhutan that they have specialized in being able to be translators, right? Between English and Sangka, which is their language. And so those people are going to be the ones that are going to be training the AI ultimately, right? And so just like that, at least for a short time, they have a job, right? Their job is you are going to be training the AI, right? And so, and then you can always, I truly believe, and you probably know this about me when it comes to blockchain and crypto, I truly believe in the decentralization also of payment. So they might, those teachers to the AI might potentially get royalties because they were the ones that then help train the AI. And so, sure, they should also get some long-term benefits of having to train that AI. And so that's something that that we're tackling right now. Something also that we're looking at is the application of AI in agriculture. One of them is being able to find in an easier way through the uses of drone than some of these mushrooms, a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. They grow at about 4,000 to 5,000 meters up in the Himalayas only. And so it's a very tough job. And the collectors have to go to the mountain and spend over there 3, 4 months, 5 months in pretty dire situation. I mean, just as you might, I'm sure, expect, the weather can change like that, right? And so it ultimately the Himalayas, right? And
so that we're talking about they're not actually farming those mushrooms. They're hunter gathering them.
Yep.
Interesting. That's right. Okay, cool. So if you could find the right conditions under which to farm them, then probably you could vastly increase production and make it simpler, safer, cheaper, all that stuff. We got to wrap this up at some point. So let's talk maybe about some of the specifics. You founded the center with the princess. Is the royal family funding this? What are your first projects? And it's built on an accelerator model, right? So local people in Bhutan can essentially start startups.
Yep.
Companies to address these issues. How are you getting the investment dollars? How's that working?
Yep. So right now, where we are right now, it's been supported, but not financially supported yet by the royal family of the government. They want to make sure that we propose to them a specific project. So right now, which that's the point that we're in right now, we have three projects that we're going to be focusing on. One is making sure that we develop the standards of what we believe all AIs should go through in terms of ethics, right? So before, the same way that, for example, myself as an engineer, I had any engineer that in the US, at least any engineer, I'm sure in the other countries, any engineer that is going to be building something where the humans are exposed to, it can be an airplane, it can be for aerospace, or aviation engineers, it can be a building for civil engineers, it can be a car, right? So before you put any engineering work next to a human, then there has to be a professional engineer that has to sign off. And that person goes through a very similar exam, just like attorneys or just like medical doctors, which is a board. And so we also believe that before any AI is being used for human consumption, that AI should go through some kind of standards in order for that AI to then be approved and then later on train or retrain, because ultimately you're talking about some kind of a human that the more that it learns, then it might think about other stuff than what you initially trained that AI to. And so that's the first one. Second one is AI into mental health care. And so one of those is being able, there's, I believe, and the princess was the one that showed that, gave me the data. I believe that there are only two psychologists or psychiatrists in the country. And so I believe only one psychologist for everyone over there, right? So, and she talked to them at some point and she told me that I simply didn't work for her at all, right? So she truly believed in then being able to have an AI that at the beginning can be just a friend. I'm not talking about having an AI that is going to be giving medical recommendations. I mean, that now you're talking about an area that can be a little bit difficult.
I just talked to an Indian startup that is doing sort of an AI friend for elder care.
Absolutely.
People are lonely, super lonely, and nobody to talk to. And this is an AI that they can chat with. Hopefully it's good. Like the chatbots we had a year ago or 2 years ago. And it's like, oh, this is an idiot. Why am I talking to this bot? But I suspect if it's at the level of ChatGPT, it might actually work. What was the third one? And then I have one more question for you.
The third one that we're tackling is AI and renewable energy. And so we're talking, they do sell energy to India, but then in the winter months, then they get, because most of their energy comes from hydro. So they have a combination of hydro from the Himalayas, and then they're ramping up on solar energy. But in the winter months, because the rivers go down, they get frozen, then they import a lot of that energy as well from India. And so they're trying to find ways to be more efficient, to optimize, then being able to select where really is the best place for solar energy, for hydro, for all, more to develop more energy, right? So those three are right now our three main focus. And cool. We have so far received the green light from the government and the royal family as well. So off we go. And so we're going to be presenting this within the next couple of weeks to the shareholders over there, or to the parties interested over there in Bhutan, as well as right now we're talking to a couple of investors that are interested in what we're doing, specifically the ethical part. And so They're interested in being able to have some kind of a merger of having people from Google and from some other companies, Microsoft, I forgot, there's another one I forgot right now, to then travel, those scientists to travel to Bhutan to go through this ethics class in Bhutan, and then being able to hopefully go back with all a new mindset in terms of how to build or keep building their own AIs.
Gotcha. So the kind of the last question I have is, how much of this AI will reside in servers in Bhutan, and how much will live on servers elsewhere, an AWS availability zone in India or something like that? Are you importing some GPUs? Are you using external models? Are you going to build some local compute?
Got it. Great question. Because of the nature of AI and the amount of power that it needs in terms of servers and all that, right? So it's not going to be in Bhutan. They don't have the infrastructure, plain and simple. So most of what we're going to be developing is going to reside, I would say, right? To use the same word, in the US. I'm making sure, and I had a conversation this morning about that with one of the companies that is interested in us building at their place, the communication. I want to make sure that there's no, that it's completely private, that there's no kind of
lag,
leakage or lag, right, as well. So it's one of those things that, yes, it can be done. This is not the first time, right? And we have plenty of experience in the U.S., in Canada as well, right? In the Western world, I guess to some extent as well, all over, with being able to transmit data in a very secure way, protected way, encrypted way. And so, yes, we're going to be looking first to put all that data in the U.S., which is going to be a very nice way for some of the other companies like Google, maybe.
Sure. It's also an interesting project, regardless of the actual projects you do, which hopefully are amazing, regardless of the local startups that are created here, which hopefully are amazing. It's an interesting project to bring AI to small countries with languages that the technology world doesn't really know about, care about. What languages is ChatGPT available in? I'm going to guess it's not the one that is mostly spoken by rural Bhutan. I'm going to guess that there's a lot of people in India with dialects, or even in China with various dialects that can't speak to ChatGPT. Even if they could connect to it, and many other countries around. And so if we're going to democratize, you talked about decentralization earlier, because you have a big background in blockchain.
Even blockchain.
If we're going to democratize access to AI globally, getting it to learn all these languages and actually speak to local people in their own language is pretty key.
Absolutely. And I'll say this. I mean, we need to do something like this. And there's a reason why I say this. And Bhutan overall, right? The royal family as well as the government, 100% have to do something like this for a specific reason. It goes very nicely and it fits very nicely with their own desire to preserve their culture. And so we have gone from preserving culture in stones, preserving culture in paper, preserving culture in software, right? And so this is a very nice way for them to then being able to make sure that then the next generations learn about their culture and things that were done, 50, 100, 200 years in the past, right?
And so much culture is embodied in language, the words that you use for something, the connotations of words. all the way you say things, the way you approach the world and understand reality is bounded. It's driven by language. Interesting point is that with AI-driven translation, we ought to be able to be much better about providing resources, information, entertainment. Of course, entertainment is the big thin edge of the wedge in driving English everywhere globally, right? Entertainment in local languages. That should be in the next few years that we can enable that to just about anybody. We have to call off time on this. I can't spend forever, but I look forward to maybe getting back with you in half a year, and seeing what startups are coming out of Bhutan and what they're doing locally, and maybe even if they've got some things that they want to bring out internationally. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much for the time. I will say that we're looking into then talking as well to the United Nations, the UN, through the royal family, to then present this new innovative combination of their culture, their GNH, which was actually adopted by the UN about 20, 30 years ago with AI. And so it's very interesting times, right, that we're living in. And I'll be more than happy to come back and give you an update with all the things that we're doing. So thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a blessing. Appreciate it.